Hi, welcome everybody. Thanks so much for coming out. What a beautiful group of people. My name is Anna Jacobs, and I'm actually just going to do some introductions of Madonna Thunderhoof and Hector Soto, who are both with us here tonight. Madonna came in from South Dakota yesterday. It's a real honor and privilege to have her here, and I had the pleasure of spending the day with her. We were out on Coney Island on the boardwalk earlier today. Lovely and sunny and bright. So I just wanted to start by introducing Madonna Thunderhoof. She's Lakota. She's a veteran of pretty much every modern Native struggle, from the occupation of Alcatraz from 69 to 71. To Mount Rushmore, 1970 to 71, the Trail of Broken Trees, BIA occupation in 72, and then culminating in the stand at Wounded Knee in 1973. In 1974, she established the We Will Remember Survival School, which is an alternative school as part of the Native Controlled Federation of Survival Schools. While also working as a cultural liaison for the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee, which handled over 500 court cases associated with Wounded Knee. She was co-founder and central organizer for WARN, Women of All Red Nations, and the Black Hills Alliance in the late 70s, which were formed to work on issues of priority to indigenous women and to protect sacred Lakota land from uranium contamination. Thunderhoof has spoken throughout the United States, Central America, Europe, and the Middle East, finding commonality in the effects of colonization with every indigenous group she spoke with, from the Irish Nationalists of Sinn Féin in 1974 visit to the Berber peoples of Libya. The most remember Kevin Costner's famous portrayal of sympathetic white soldier John Dunbar. His personal commitment to the Black Hills were revealed as a sham in his attempt to develop an ostentatious casino resort with a golf course and railroad access. Thunderhoof organized against this exploitation of the Black Hills and was able to stop the corporate development. In the late 90s, she returned to the Cheyenne River Reservation to engage in community organizing and become a member of the school board, housing board, and establish the Swift Bird Ayote Center, believing that community organizing was the closest way to recreate the experience of living free in Wounded Knee. She has continued this work, most recently with her work as a tribal liaison for the Lakota People's Law Project, which is working to represent on behalf of grandparents, a civil rights case against the South Dakota Social Services, Department of Social Services. So the work there is focused on stopping the removal of Indian children, which is a very, very large problem, and many of those children are ending up off the reservation away from their culture and their people. And from some of the stories I heard today, young mothers are really, really being robbed of their children, and losing their parental rights without any legal recourse at all. So that is some of what she'll be talking about today, her work there. And then to kind of bring us into the New York landscape a little bit, we have Hector Soto, who is a longtime Puerto Rican activist, raised in the Bronx, lived in Manhattan for the first 2 years of his life. And he's an activist, organizer, and lawyer. He's worked extensively against police brutality and racism in both Philly and New York City. Currently, Hector is the director of a school for organizers, the Center for Neighborhood Leadership. And this school works to both train new organizers as well as support organizers, basically from burnout. Yeah. So it's a very, very important school, which offers a lot of tools for, you know, many people at different kind of levels of doing community-based organizing. So he's also, teaching a class at Hostess called The Role of Police in a Democratic Society, which I would really like to be taking right now. Curious about how that works. But anyways, I welcome you all. So thanks so much for being here. You know, supporting the work of the Lakota People's Law Project and hearing from Madonna Thunder Hutton as well as Hector. Thank you both.
Thank you. Just a quick note on the course that I teach. There are two big problems in that course. One is the police, and the other is democratic society. Both have to be addressed. I have the honor and pleasure of introducing Madonna Thunderhawk to you formally. And I feel very honored individually, personally, to have the opportunity and to be sitting here with someone who deserves the title of hero, someone who understands and has understood for a long time that the struggle for dignity and the struggle for respect is the struggle that counts. And if there's a tie-in between the struggles that I've been involved with here in New York City, Puerto Rican, non-white, and I've been called nigger, I've been called spick, even once I was walking out of the subway where the public library is, and these two Hasidic Jews were coming down the other end, and one of them said, dirty Arab. I said, oh, okay. That's only happened once. But we are both, the struggles for the Puerto Rican community in New York City has been, you know, a struggle for respect, a struggle for recognition of our dignity, our value, our cultural identity, and to be put on the same plane as everybody else. And that sounds, to some people, that's not even understandable. But the reality is, you know, in my own life, I was born in Bellevue Hospital. It may explain a lot of things. But and when I was born, my father told me this. He put on he told them on the birth certificate should be Hector Guillermo Soto Acosta. Guillermo being Spanish for William, and Soto Acosta being the tradition at the time in Puerto Rico, and to some extent even today in Latin America, that the mother's maiden name goes after the father's name, and there's a dash in between. When they got the birth certificate, all it had was Hector William Soto. And he asked for an explanation, and he wasn't given any other than, well, this is the way we do it here. And so, in some ways, even from the moment of my birth, it was, you don't exist on your terms. You only exist on our terms. And my struggle growing up, and as I developed and became conscious, has been a struggle to reclaim and have the right to exercise and be Hector Guillermo Soto Acosta, and everything that means, and everything that came before that. And with the Lakota people, with all of the Native American people, that has been a struggle that has been, from the moment that the whites arrived, Europeans arrived on this land, it has been their attempt to not only psychologically and emotionally, but physically eliminate the indigenous people who are the people who, this is their land. This is their land. Everyone who's come here is the visitor. I remember a long time ago in the 60s, and I don't remember the person's name, but it was a Native American who flew to Italy and got off the plane in Italy and planted the flag of his nation and said, I claim this nation. I claim Italy for this nation. Sounds a little absurd, but that's exactly what they did here. And so the absurdity of you and the struggle, the anguish and the pain and the destruction that that struggle has caused, not the struggle, but the imposition of this power and force on our communities has been incredible. The Puerto Rican community in the South Bronx continues to, in spite, if you go to the South Bronx, you're going to see a lot of nice new buildings, you're going to see some parks, you're going to see things that weren't there 30 years ago. On the other hand, we still have the highest poverty rate in the United States. We have in the district that immediately surrounds Yankee Stadium, the congressional district, which Yankee Stadium is part, is the poorest congressional urban district in the United States. Poverty is grinding. We have the highest rates of asthma. We have the highest rates of diabetes. Unfortunately, in the South Bronx, we lead in everything that's negative, right? And before the 60s, when we reclaimed our legitimacy and our dignity and our identity, we were taught that it's our fault. And there are forces out there today that want us to go in that same direction. That if you're poor, it's because you don't have ambition, because you're lazy, because you don't have the smarts to make it. And that's the way they would like to run the country. But it's really about being economically exploited, being the victims of a cultural chauvinism that has no bounds, even to the present, being the victims of outright racism. A racism that, with the Native Americans, took the form of open genocide against Native people. And the Puerto Rican community just took the form of, hey, we'll make it so terrible for you, you're going to die, and you'll keep dying, and that's fine, we don't care about it. But it was a policy of the government to eliminate Native people. If it's not, it continues to be, I think, the policy of the government to eliminate Native people and anyone who's not part of the mainstream. We are the victims of a continuing attempt to convince everyone that we are less than, and our cultures do not have the same dignity, weight, and value as any other culture in the world. So that when I stand up and or when I play my music loud in the car with the windows open, I play my salsa, you know, now it's because I'm losing my hearing. Before, it was to make a cultural statement that my music has value, this came from us, and it's worth listening to. I can listen to classical music and appreciate it. I can listen to all kinds of music and appreciate it. How come you can't appreciate what's come out of my culture on the same terms? So, I'm going to end with this. In 1981, 30 years ago, I've been around for a while. There was a movie that came out called Fort Apache, the Bronx. I don't know how many of you have heard of it. And it starred Paul Newman, who was really big then. I mentioned Paul Newman in my class the other day in context with the Pinkertons and the Sundance Kid. Everybody looked at me, who? Big actor, Paul Newman. And this movie portrayed, allegedly was portraying what was going on in the South Bronx through the eyes of two white police officers. And what the movie did, and I was part of the people organizing against that movie, its production, because it was filmed in the South Bronx, its release, and after its release we picketed movie theaters in the South Bronx to prevent people, to ask people not to go, not to support it. But the depiction was of every conceivable negative stereotype about Puerto Ricans and Latinos generally, and especially in the South Bronx. And the only decent people were the white police officers and the other white characters in the film. We also protested that movie because we understood that it was an insult and a slight to the Native American people of the United States and around the world. Because the whole concept of the movie was that Fort Apache, which was the 41st precinct in the Bronx, that somehow this was the only place of civilization and civility in a wilderness filled with savages who knew no bounds. And we felt that insult, but we also understood that it was an insult to all of our Native American brothers, because it denied, they weren't a wilderness. They had a life, a culture, a vibrant societies, you know, and the forts were the ones that had to be eliminated. I just bought a button back there, and I'm going to end it with this and introduce Madonna, that it says, I don't know who the Native American is, person is holding a rifle and said, all my heroes shoot cowboys.
Geronimo.
All my heroes shoot cowboys. And I think, you know, that is the perspective that counts. That is the perspective that counts. And with all legitimacy, it counts. Because they were attacked, we were attacked. And so in that one movie, even before we knew we didn't know what was going on, we understood that this was the same struggle with the South Bronx that is occurring out with Native peoples. And at that time, we understood it to be in the Midwest, Chicanos out in the West Coast, Black people throughout the United States, and all people who find themselves oppressed and exploited in this country. And so that's why Puerto Rican is here, to introduce Madonna Thunderhawk. So it is my personal pleasure, it is my my honor, my privilege to introduce Madonna Thunderhawk, who will speak to you about her continuing struggles for her people.
Thank you. Okay, I wanted to... just sitting here looking at this picture. Well, first of all, I'm really honored to be here. Most of you in here are young, way younger than me. But it's really good to just be around all of you, because you're young, but you've got something going. You've got politics, so you wouldn't be here. I come from an area where there's nothing like this. And even with my own people and our extended family, my sister and I support each other in what we talk about, and the things we do, and our continued work, because we don't have this community like this. Everybody's scratching for a living, everybody's worried about how they're gonna pay the utilities and stuff, and nobody has time for anything else. So I'm just glad I got to come. I'm gonna be here for a few days, and to me it's like a little kind of a mini vacation even, because years ago when I came to, different ones are asking me, oh yeah, have you ever been here before? And I said, oh yeah, I was here, you know, like 30 some years ago. The American Indian Movement was working with the National Council of Churches, and they helped, we formed the International Indian Treaty Council, and the Council of Churches got us an office at UN Plaza, 777 UN Plaza anyway. So we had to all take turns coming from way out there in Indian country. We had to take turns coming into New York and to that place and work. So we didn't get to see anything. We just got to come to this big city, and you know, we stayed at the different places, but we just went back and forth, and then we went home. So I got to go to Coney Island, to the boardwalk, and I only see that on TV or in the movies, you know. And so to me it was just that feeling of being able to kind of take a break, you know. And then I was looking at this picture, which was taken back in 1980. And I was looking at that and I thought, geez, that's a long time ago. But this picture was taken at the International a survival gathering we had in the Black Hills of South Dakota. At that time, we had put together an organization called the Black Hills Alliance. And up until that time, we were in complete odds with the white ranchers and farmers in the state, because it was a land struggle and they still have the frontier mentality. I mean, everything, you know, the results of Wounded Knee, you name it. But a greater threat came in the form of Union Carbide. They came to the Black Hills. They were going to look for uranium. So I don't know how it happened, but we ended up with white farmers and ranchers and Indian people banding together in a Black Hills Alliance to fight this corporation. And we ran them out of the Black Hills. They weren't going to make any money. They weren't meeting any of their deadlines. And their world is all about making money. So we just drug out the protest against it. We even filed all kinds of what do they call it, with the federal court to stop
injunction,
yeah, things like that, you know, just to delaying tactics. And eventually, after several months, they just picked up and left. So after that, we decided then that we could see what was going on. We got an education of outside what was outside of our reservations, our communities in South Dakota, what was happening in the rest of the country, especially with the uranium industry at the time. So we were a part of the No Nukes movement of that day, and we put on this survival gathering, and people came from all over. And it was like a 10-day event. And that's when I learned all about wind power, solar energy, all that, and how you could, I mean, this is 30 years ago, you know, and finally 30 years later, they're talking about it in real terms, since the global warming and you name it. But at that time, we were considered alarmists and et cetera. But it's been a long struggle on all levels back in the Dakotas, because when we start, our struggle is not just one facet. Because we are a people, and the American Indian Movement was successful in what we did in those days because we were a movement of our people, of all ages. I remember the local newspaper there in South Dakota, Rapid City, in the western part of the state, did an interview with one of the tribal chairmen at that time, who were, you know, just afraid of the federal government, and they were just, you know, didn't want to be associated with the American Indian Movement because they were afraid, you know, we were rocking the boat and what happened. So anyway, they interviewed him, and he said, well, you know, the American Indian Movement, they don't represent Indian people. They don't speak for us, he said. They're just made up of the young, the old, and the have-nots. So, of course, I think that, you know, told a story right there of what was happening. And like I said, why we were successful in terms of what happened to change federal Indian policy. Because that's what we've lived under all these many years. Not only federal Indian policy, but state laws, county. So we live under a whole lot of laws. So it's always been a struggle for survival on all levels. So that's why when the 60s and the 70s, the struggle still went on, the issues are still there, You know, it's just a never-ending struggle on for environmental issues, whatever. But because there was policy change due to the Red Power movement of those days, it wasn't only the American Indian movement, there was other, you know, organizations that were formed all over the country on different reservations. So there was, the Red Power movement was successful in actually changing federal Indian policy, which at that time was a policy of termination. And that meant terminating all the federal statutes, all the treaty laws. See, the treaties that were made with the Indian people were, the majority of them were ratified by Congress, which made them the law of the land. And of course, they were cast aside immediately, mainly for gold and other, you know, minerals, oil, what have you. So, it was around most of the struggle we had was the media turned it into just a, you know, violence and gun-toting Indian men. The women were invisible. We had no native press or media at the time. It was all local white media. And so we, the women of the Red Power movement, we were all invisible. Which at the time didn't matter because we were in this fight, okay? And what it did do, though, was broadcast it around the world. And so there was a lot of political pressure that came from all over. And the alliances we had with the Puerto Rican people, with the Mexican-American people, with the Black Panthers, we had alliances with a lot of people. We had support committees, Native American support committees nationwide with people that weren't indigenous, that weren't people of color, but they supported our efforts. And as a result of that, federal Indian policy changed from termination to self-determination. So a lot, we've seen some headway. And a lot of people say, well, oh, the government's been so bad, they treated you so bad, why would you want to do this, why would you want to do that? We're in a survival mode, and we've always been in a survival mode since the invasion. The European invasion, we've been in survival mode. And what does that mean? What is survival? By whatever means necessary to survive. And our ancestors made those treaties because they knew what was coming. And our people of the Northern Plains, we became wards of the government due to the policies as a result of the treaties. Rather than enforce the treaties, the government started making all kinds of statutes and laws and things like that. But it was all done for survival. And our people were, it was a war of attrition against our people, our ancestors. I mean, we were wiped out, almost wiped out by disease alone. The United States government at that time was just getting done with the Civil War. They had battles on the southern border. I mean, they were in a weakened condition. That's why they made treaties with the northern tribe, the Northern Plains tribes, because our people were what they call nowadays guerrilla war fighters, hit and run, that type. So they couldn't. That's why the treaties were, it wasn't initiated by our ancestors, it was initiated by the federal government. They wanted peace. And so our people, our ancestors, worked with them because they knew what was coming. The disease is what was the worst. We had no defense against things like measles, even chicken pox, whooping cough, all the European diseases that they brought. So that's why we're in this position we're in now. We have this special relationship with the federal government to maintain what small parcels of land we have left. But that's our identity. Once we lose that, then we're just like everybody else in this country. We'll just be one of the many poor people. Statistics. So when people say, well, things are so bad, why don't you just leave that reservation? You know? It's so obvious that they don't understand, and they never will. Only indigenous people, indigenous to whatever land they're in, understand. So the struggle goes on, you know, intergenerational struggle. And I look back now and there isn't anything, I wouldn't change anything. When I was young, I did some real goofy things and foolish things, but I was young, you know. And youth is wasted on the young, so, but you know, I learned as I went along, you know, I learned it. And my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, I feel okay about it, you know. I feel good about it, that I've been able to be a part of the struggle to maintain my identity and who I am and my people. And a little something I just want to bring up. I noticed that I don't think a lot of people, they say, oh, North Dakota. Oh, okay, now where is that? Dakota. And then I see there's that name is used a lot in the modern day. I mean, there's people, movie stars and stuff that are named Dakota. You know, in my people, there's three dialects. One is the L, Lakota, Lakota. And that word means allies. Oyate means people. But Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, three dialects, and it all means allies. That's what that word means. The Nakota mostly now are in southern Alberta, Canada. Lakotas are the, what they call the Teton, or the western Oyate. And the Dakotas were the woodland further east. And our territory was almost to Texas, into Canada, Rocky Mountains, and clear into Wisconsin was our land, our hunting grounds. Didn't own it. Our ancestors had no concept of owning the land. It was just like, you might as well say, well, we own the sky, or we own the air. Our ancestors didn't have that concept. It was the hunting grounds, and it was shared. And the disease was, they said, oh, well, the Western movement of the pioneers or whoever pushed your people west. It was the disease that pushed our people. It was the disease that wreaked havoc with our ancestors. But anyway, I just feel like the work I'm doing now is a continuation, because it's dealing again with survival. The survival of who we are, and we're at a real dangerous, dangerous place right now. Because we've been outmaneuvered by the modern day communication system. Every home practically on the reservation has some kind of game thing, or you know, that kind of technology. Everybody has a cell phone. The young people are just all, this is the thing that works the most, is their thumbs, because they're on something like that. Even my great grandkids, you know, I don't allow those things in my house. I leave them at home if you're going to come visit me, because I want to talk to you. I don't want to see your forehead and your thumbs. You know? I mean, it's really dangerous because we are subject to all of that. We're subject to all the abuses, alcohol, drugs, you name it. We're subject to all of that. But it's on top of that, most dangerous of all is what's happening to our little ones now. They're being taken. And not everybody, not all of them, and here and there, there is a good foster home, and over here, this, you know, stand this family up and show how this, that, and the other thing, but the majority are affected by the Department of Social Service theft of the children, and it's all about money. The state of South Dakota could care less about Native children. But until the mid-90s, when federal policy, thanks to the Republicans-dominated Congresses at the time, the policies, federal funding was changed from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to where the states could apply directly to the federal government for funding for child welfare. And it was done in a real subtle and under the table kind of way, because most of the tribal governments at the time, in the Dakotas anyway, South Dakota, were dealing with environmental disasters, major snowstorms and things like that. When that hits most of the reservations in South Dakota, that means it's rural, all rural. The roads are closed down, everything shuts down, everything. The, you know, electricity, you name it. I mean, there has to be practically airlifts, you know, for food and water and things. I mean, those types of things going on, plus other cuts, budget cuts on health care and all. So the tribal governments are all dealing with those emergency type stuff constantly. In the summertime, it was droughts, things like that. So this was all done in a real subtle way. And I didn't even notice until all of a sudden I noticed there was this big, brand new building on our reservation, and I said, what's that? Oh, that's social services. So I said, oh, well, gee, finally. I didn't know it was the South Dakota, the state. See, there's a big line there between federal jurisdiction and the state jurisdiction. And it's always been Indian country as federal jurisdiction, which meant the tribal governments operate. The supreme law of the land is, of course, the federal, you know, government. The state jurisdiction stops at the reservation line. But they maneuvered and got special legislation passed to where they applied directly to the state did to the federal government for all the child welfare money. So now they could build offices on all the reservations. And overnight, happened overnight. And then that was, and they just, all of their non-native, non-indigenous thinking kicked in. To the state, social services, their concept is not of the extended family. Okay, we have a real dysfunctional set of parents here, or the mother is, you know, too young to, she's a, you know, single mother or a teenager, whatever. The family always took up the slack. It was usually the grandmother that would end up with, you know, taking care of the children. Extended family somewhere would step in. But with the state, you can't do that. They deal only with the parent. And they say it's for the safety of the child, they have to be removed. Because the grandmother will let them see their mother. And we can't have that. The grandmother is part of the family. She'll let those children see everybody. We can't have that. So that's how they're wearing, you know, using to destroy that family. So to make a long story short, we, after working 5 years on this issue and trying to get the tribal governments to step up to the plate, and a lot of organizing went on for that, we found out that the parents, a lot of them are real young parents, they had a lot of problems, dysfunctional family. The one, they were hard to, they wouldn't stay with it in the struggle for their kids. It was the grandmothers that were standing, that would step up and say, you know, they're not taking my grandkids. And they were the ones that would fight for them. So that's who we're working with now, so they can get, their civil rights are being violated because they're not being considered as extended family kinship care. Where it's almost automatic in some states that we found out where that they consider that. Because the state doesn't want to take care of all these kids, they don't have the money, so they'll look for a relative to take these kids. Not in South Dakota, not with Native children. They get special funding when it comes to Native children, because they're a targeted population. They get a lot of money. I'm not good on statistics. I should know this stuff by heart, but I don't. But we're talking millions and millions of dollars, okay? That's propped up the Department of Social Services for the state of South Dakota. They've got all this whole bureaucracy built up around it now. They're not about to give up control. So our attorney, we have a volunteer attorney that was working with us, and he went with a couple other people that volunteers to come and help us. And they met with the Attorney General of the state of South Dakota. This is a few years back. There's a new one now, but about the violation of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was passed in 1978, federal law that's supposed to stop the wholesale ripoff of Native children, because it was going on back then. So that's what that law was passed. But the state of South Dakota since then has chosen to just ignore the law. So our attorney sat down and had this meeting with the Attorney General, and he just kind of laughed it off. He said, well, come on now. You know, that's just not part of how we do things. And in other words, who's going to make us follow this law? Nobody. And so basically we just laughed. We said, well, you know, if you want us to follow that law follow it for a while, you're just going to have to sue us. And he laughed. So I thought about it and said, well, okay. That's what we'll do then. And it's a hard road, because we're a tax, non-profit tax exempt. But of course our funding doesn't come from anywhere in our area of the country. You know, any state that has a large Native population, it's just frontier mentality, it's just racism. So we have our organization that we operate under is the Romero Institute, and they're the tax shelter, and they do the fundraising for us. But just as we were getting going pretty good, then that's when the financial collapse happened. And a lot of our major funding was coming from outside the country. But that was for the whole legal end of it, the civil rights case. But for our work, organizing work with the grandparents and the families in South Dakota, that was money that was coming from donors in the United States. But that dried up immediately. When the financial collapse happened, everybody just, you know, grabbed all their money, I guess they could, and put it under the mattress, you know, rather than put it in a bank that was failing. So we are really hurting now, hurting big time. But we can't quit. You know, I'm the only staff person now. Because I'm on Social Security, so they don't have to pay me. I do get a stipend for gas for my jalopy to drive around the state, but now the gas is almost $4 a gallon in South Dakota, so that's questionable. Plus car insurance, you know, all of that stuff. But that's how it is. That's why we call it struggle, you know? And it goes on and on and on and on. But I haven't done this. It's the first time I've done this in, say, gosh, how many years? Maybe, I don't know, maybe 30 years? 20 years at least, I haven't done this kind of thing. So it was really, I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to go try it. Go talk, and that's going to be interesting. That's going to be kind of fun because I haven't done it for so long. But I just didn't think there was anybody anymore that was interested in anything like this. I thought it all went away in the 60s and 70s. I thought everybody changed and all became money grubbers, you know? And I didn't know.
No money to grub.
Yeah. Well, there must be. They're still all rich people all over.
They're what Teen Street.
Yeah. I know in South Dakota, my son-in-law, he does floor coverings, custom tile setter and stuff. And there's homes going up in the Black Hills just where they're putting up marble bathrooms that are probably half as big as this room. Because he works on it. He does tile, he does the marble, and he comes back and says, you guys won't believe what their people are coming in, building. And they're coming into the Dakotas because the crime rate is low. There's no state taxes. I mean, it's a free ride for the rich people. So yeah, there's money out there, not for us, not for you and I, but whatever collapse there was, it didn't touch those people. They're well and happy, you know? But anyway, I was just really, really glad to come, and I'm just glad that many of you showed up to hear, you know, what's really going on, still going on, you know. When I was being a tourist today, thanks to Anna, she took me around. She's probably thinking, oh, I get to be a tour guide. But anyway, it was, you know, I was talking about the UN when we were here at UN Plaza and what the work we were doing then. And different ones asked me, I forget, yesterday, anyway, they were saying, so what were you doing there at the UN? Well, we were trying to get organized with other indigenous people in Central and South America, Alaska, and the indigenous of the Western Hemisphere to get recognition, the UN, and we knew that was going to be a struggle. I mean, it had to start with some obscure committee of the UN and do a subcommittee of a subcommittee of a subcommittee, you know. You had to work your way up to the biggest bureaucracy in the world. Well, guess what? Last year they got that, what was it called? The past of the UN for the indigenous. Anyway, got it done. Taken, 30 some years, but we got it done. People, the word indigenous is now recognized. But while we were there, another thing that happened that I don't know if many of you are too young to remember, but if you know anything about the history of struggle in this country, back then, the Shah of Iran was, they overthrew the government, the students kicked him out, and they were, of course, just the United States government was the evil one because they were buddies with the Shah. So the Iranian students, took over the U.S. embassy, and they held all those embassy workers hostage. And this went on and on and on, months and months and months. Well, there we were sitting in the UN plaza under the arm of the National Council of Churches, and with the tie up with the fledgling organization of the International Indian Treaty Council. We were the only organization that would, the Iranian students and government would allow to carry mail to the hostages. So once every month, a couple guys would come in from out west, South Dakota, wherever, volunteered, and they, of course they had to be, you know, scrutinized by the feds and everybody, and there'd be big sacks of mail, big huge sacks of mail from all the families of these hostages. And there were people that were just as right wing as America can get, but they didn't want anything to do, you know, they didn't care who it was carrying their mail. You know, their loved ones were being held hostage and what have you. So, but you don't read that anywhere. That's not written anywhere. It's just like it didn't happen. But I remember being in the office there when they'd all get ready and load up those big sacks of mail, and a special courier plane would come and take them to Iran. And then they'd get the mail from the hostages and bring it back to them. And the National Council of Churches are the ones that facilitated that whole thing. So I said, so that's what I was doing, you know, way back then, when we were just starting out for international recognition. Okay, I talked enough now. I want questions and answers. Q&A. Thank you.
Questions, comments, yes?
Hi, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I just came into the room, however. I listened to your speech this morning, Miss Amosy. I got lost at the radio station trying to find my way back here. But I want to know, why is it family court deal with us like guilty before innocent? And more so, my kids, them was taken from me for and they're 10 years plus. You read the right what she said on the program this morning. They're destroying these kids. These kids are the future of tomorrow. But exploiting them one way is one way. But on the Freedom of Information Act, not even the court transcript, I can get to appeal my case to the appellate division. When I asked the appellate division for also the court transcript, they refused to give me a free lawyer, much less the court transcript. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know nothing about the law, but I'm a type of person that stand up 1,000 or more percent for my right, especially when I did my kids no wrong, and I'm seeing disability discrimination being used also. My daughter was traumatized in the system from they took her like 6-7 year old. I got her back in August 2005. And they traumatized her to an extent that she was reading at a 2-3 grade level. And still up to this day, I'm fighting for Section 504 under the Disability Act law, a process her case successfully with SSI. Now they just took her back in the system because they refused to give her home instruction schooling. Mm-hmm. They refused to give us proper housing. The uniform court system, nothing does seem to be working with ACS, as you put it. It's just far more exploitation and kidnapping in the system, as I'm seeing. It's a prison pipeline, I must say. You know, so how can we deal with it, maybe trying to dissolve ACS? We need them out of town, you know, because they're destroying these kids that are the future for tomorrow. The fact that I'm here, my daughter still learning at a 2-3 grade level, they pushing her in high school, they put me back in family court for like 2006 to current moment. The judge don't want to even listen what home instruction schooling under Section 504 is. It's a civil right and a human right violation to shortchange these kids of even a proper education. It's like they want them to come out in society while they ignore us and not be civilized to even do what they must do, adequately right for these children. You know, and it's a crying shame, because anything hurt my daughter while they have her on the involuntary placement or more, it does hurt me. You know, I'm suing the mayor just to say with a 2.8 million lawsuit right now. And it's like, under section 504, it says under the law, you could be suing the city, the state, the federal government, the school, the community, as such, to get these type of education that don't necessarily fall under special education. Because you put them on the special education, use test score, which is still failing them, and it's not going anywhere for us. I have two more of my kids drop out of school because of the average frustration with the pushing them and forcing us around under the system that's not adequately doing us any good in this country. I'm from Jamaica, West Indies, I must say, you know, Kingston One, and I'm, you know, I fear no evil. You know, I try to ask God to guide me in my going out and my coming in, but it's how best can we protect these kids when they're brainwashing them nevertheless in the system? It's a long question, but I'm sorry to say me.
Well, I'm not from here, but all I can, you know, refer to is what I know, but I've never depended on the system ever to do anything. You have to be, you have to organize yourself, and even if there's one, you gotta go out there, you gotta find more. Even it only takes, it doesn't take a, you know, at least where I'm from, there's maybe six of us that I can count, grandmothers, that are moving this thing along. There's a lot of support, a lot of talk, a lot of people, but you gotta have people that will actually work with you and help you, and you got to work together, and that's empowerment, and you got to stay with it, and that's what we've done. You know, we still have a long way to go, but some of the grandmothers are getting their grandkids back. We've been on the National Public Radio, and they're going to come out and they're going to do a series now, because it seems like now there's evidence also of all the federal dollars that the state has gotten and what they're diverting the funds to. You know, it's not to child care or anything like that, child welfare. So that's all I can say that we've done, because we have the same problem as you. No one was listening. No one's going to do anything.
Nobody,
you have to organize yourself, you know.
Nobody seems to be speaking out. The radio station is really guiding us. You know, and I appreciate that much coming from the radio station. Because it's like everybody's silent and afraid of somebody.
Well, I think that Madonna's point about doing it in a more collective way is, and I'm not an expert in what the family courts do, but finding, there are organizations that can give you a couple of leads after this about organizations that may be able to give you some support and help, but it is more about doing it in a collective way than an individual way, because individually they have all the advantages and you have all the disadvantages, and it is the power of the numbers versus their organized money and their organized power.
David and Goliath's story.
Right. Right, and so I mean that. So afterwards, I can give you a couple of
thanks.
Yes.
I just want to thank you for coming. Thank you very much. I've always been wanting to meet a representative of the American Indian Movement, because they motivated myself to push for the Associated Indigenous Movement. Their values and their goals, they've always impressed me. With regard to the support in the past from other organizations of color, is there still like a current strong support equivalent to the past? And also with regard to the Indigenous recognition in the UN that passed last year, do you foresee or would you support an Indigenous recognition of the indigenous of Latin America, like a federal recognition, like in the BIA. For example, like indigenous people of Latin America being recognized just as the indigenous people of Canada are recognized in the BIA.
You know, they, from what I try to keep up with this stuff, but we have a good native media now, you know, so they have stay on top of this so we can read about it, what's happening. But the indigenous of Central and South America are really organized. In the past 30 years, they went from meeting individuals in Europe that were, they couldn't go back to their country because they were working for recognition of their people. But from that situation to today, where they're organized and a lot, and they're calling themselves indigenous to whatever their original, you know, people were named in their languages and stuff. And they are organized. They are organized. Our tribal chairman last 2 years ago, he went as a delegate to Peru to this large indigenous congress. So they are getting organized to the point where they're recognized in their different, whatever country they are, as indigenous people. And I think it's going to come, and they're going to do it. They're going to get that recognition, and they're going to be the indigenous people of the South are going to be there, a reckoning, because they're the majority in those countries. And they know it, and they're getting organized, and can't wait.
I understand, but I meant specifically here, like in indigenous born here who are like recognized as Hispanic, usually, mm-hmm. You know, those like.
Oh, you mean in the United States?
Yes.
Oh, well, you know what? I don't see why not. We are indigenous. You know. Our people didn't cross the borders crossed us. We don't have to ask for that recognition. We just get organized and do it. That's how I think, anyway.
I'd like to thank you for coming to speak to us. Your spirit is so strong in this room. And it was nice to hear you say what you did. And first thing I want to ask is, what is the name of your organization?
Okay, we're the, you mean the grandmothers or the law project?
How can we help you?
Okay. Yes! Woo! Okay, it's the Lakota People's, Lakota People's Law Project.org.
We're online.
Okay. Good. Now, were you on to Kyokusin this morning?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't work today, so I didn't listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. He's my nephew.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't get to see him yet. Yeah.
I please forgive me if I make a speech. It's not my intent to make a speech. What you're experiencing and what you experience, we now experience in New York fully. I work with people who have ACS cases, and all systems that are in poor areas or really institutionalized racism.
Yeah.
Everything, every system that we have. You did mention that that in South Dakota, if you're an Indian, you get paid more money if you go to prison. The prison gets paid more money.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you go to prison. Because it's once again, it's a state thing, and they get extra money for that. So it's all revolves around money, and for poor people now, it used to be all simply people of color, but it's not anymore.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is exactly right. There are people, and there are groups, there are organizations now. I work in a place called Reality House. And in our place, we call our clients relatives.
Yeah.
We don't call them clients, we don't call them patients. Because we're all related.
Yeah.
And in this, we believe in social justice. We teach our relatives that come in here how to negotiate the system. Because it's a full-time job to negotiate the system. If you go and apply for aid, for any kind of welfare in the system that we operate in New York City, you're gonna have to go through hoops.
Yeah.
And they're gonna give you $68.50 every 2 weeks. And they think that they're giving you money, and you're gonna have to earn that by attending all these programs. And they're now, like you said, they're not, their first choice is not the family anymore.
Yeah.
It's becoming the second choice now. And that's ridiculous, because oftentimes some of the clients come for the use of marijuana. Okay? So they're using marijuana, they're not using it every day, they use it for a reason. They have kids that have emotional problems, they send the kids to special education, a doctor decides how much medication they're supposed to take, and then the parent has no right to fight the amount of medication that the child is forced to take. And I'm not just making this up, I'm a social worker. So all this stuff.
Yeah.
So we educate our clients, we tell them how to advocate for each other. And in our organization, we work as a community, and we continually try to teach them what they need to do, because it's all been community work. So what you offered me today was more hope. Because I know that there are organizations in the city, and I know that this kind of work can be done.
Yeah.
You know, I send a certain amount of money every month to South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do whatever I can financially myself, but the main thing is to educate people that there is a serious issue here. And one of the organizations that is really powerful is an organization called Undoing Racism. And in this organization, what it does is it verifies all the things that we think are happening as true. So we identify the solution, and then from then you go on and organize. Organize in your community, and because you have a much stronger voice.
Yeah.
And because if one person's trying to fight that, what you're saying, and everybody knows it's untrue, that person isn't going to have any effect. You have to work as a community. You have to work tirelessly. I mean, I'm an older now, and I feel so bad, because all this stuff that you're talking about, I know what that thing was last year, but I forgot it too.
Yeah.
I'm just an older, and I wanted to be an elder, you know, and just sort of take it easy, and just sort of whatever I said was okay, but no.
Yeah.
No, I have to still look at every side, I have to still fight everything, I have to look at all the sides of this stuff, because it's not black and white.
Yeah.
It's all these gray areas that we have to fight in, because it's for them, it's all about money.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll take you so far and you'll fall off the cliff. I'm sorry for the speech.
Just a footnote on
thank you.
A footnote.
Website. Sorry, I must give a website for information and protection further to everyone in this room. It's called www.cchi.com. They have a DVD called Psychiatrists and Industry of Debt that Family Coach use on us. They teach us what psychiatrists and industry of debt does to us wrongly in family court. They teach about the killing with the drugs issue, drugging these kids, etc., etc. So it's like Citizen Commission on Human Rights International.
One last thing, absolutely. You are allies. Okay, we need to have allies.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be not people of color. They have to be everyone who's interested and willing to do this. Because this is important. It can't be done by just indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
We have to trust our allies. And there are some out there.
Yeah.
I just
want to
say thank you so much for being so happy and honored to hear you speak and to meet you. I wanted to find out, you're saying that all the young people are on the technology. Is there anyone doing kind of activism by using social network media like Twitter? Because I feel like this information would probably be spread all over the internet, Twitter, Facebook, etc. If people knew about it. I found out about this because of an event I came to last week and I posted it, but I feel like there'd be more people posting it. Is there any way to kind of use the technology of the young, is there any younger people who know about the technology who are interested in these things who would be willing to start Twitter pages, to get on Huffington Post, just all these kind of ways the internet is being used to help communities understand what's going on around the world?
Okay, there is an organization called Thunder Valley, and it's a youth group that's in. They're doing some real good things, some amazing things, but they're also focused, I think, on small community economic projects for young people, because that's what the young people were saying is, you know, we don't want to sit and hear people talk at us and tell us this, that, and that. We want money. We want to do something. You know, we don't have anything to do. So they started this whole thing. It's called Tatanka bars, and they're health bars made of buffalo meat. They're the traditional food of our people, but they're energy bars, and there's you know, no preservatives in them. I mean, that whole thing, and that just took off. So these young people now, they made hot dogs that are healthy, a healthy hot dog made out of buffalo meat. Because buffalo meat, the American bison meat, doesn't have any cholesterol in it. That's why my ancestors were so healthy. Because they ate mostly buffalo meat and, of course, other wild game. But they're making hot dogs out of it because all kids love hot dogs. So it took a while for them to develop this hot dog that a kid would like. You know, it's got to have that kid taste. And so what they're working on now is building these little hot dog stands, because back home they have what they call the in our language it's wachipi, that means a dance, a gathering, a social dance, and in English, I don't know where the word came from, but they call it powwow. But anyway, but everybody seems to understand that, so everybody, you know, and they have them all over in the summer. It's like a circuit. Every reservation and every community off the reservation that has a large Indian community, they have these, and they're just, everybody comes. So they have all these food stands, and you know, it's just a cool thing. Anyway, and that's what keeps our people together. That's what keeps the culture alive. And so that's what they're doing. They're starting, and they're having these hot dog stands at these powwows, so that they can make money, but also it's something healthy, and it's traditional food.
I guess the last question: Do you have a webmaster for your website? Is there one person that's running your website, or how does that? I'm just interested in how to get the word. Okay, so if I write info to blah blah blah, somebody can help. Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So much. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Could you talk a little bit about immersion schools and the history or what kind of impact they've had in your community?
Well, we started out with the survival schools back in the 60s and 70s, and they developed, we remember survival school was the first alternative type, you know, it wasn't really a school, it was like a survival group, okay, in the state. But now it's been, on the reservations, they have the regular high schools, for example, and then they'll have the alternative type, and with different names and different, you know, concepts and stuff. But it's basically an alternative to the regular school system. They have them now in the regular states, you know, the city schools and the non-Indian schools have them also. So it's a concept that you know, started way back then, and it's developed to the point where it's a viable, accepted, you know, way of doing, because there were so many dropouts and in the regular school system, and there still is, you know, so these alternative school type schools programs are a part of the regular school system, so they're not separate like they used to be. And in a way, it's good, but there's still a lot. You know, they've got to watch out them because they're part of the system. They'll try to water everything down. You know, but they, it's a good thing.
Anybody else? Oh.
On the point of recognition that you're talking about in the beginning, Arthur?
Yes.
First time I've ever heard anybody mention, like, in, like outside of Canada, there were people living here before us, right? So I was wondering, like, for like a movement that refers back to the 60s all the time in the US, what happened to all those alliances where people don't really include, like the American Indian experience in like their anti-colonial analysis?
Well, I think there are still alliances and there are still movements. I think, you know, I can speak somewhat for more authoritatively in the Puerto Rican community, Latino community. There's a couple of things. One, there is a generational gap that has taken place. The people that came out of that were active in the 60s, maybe the 70s, in many cases have not really paved the way for younger people to come up and work, become the new leaders, the new organizers. I mean, I spend most of my time now trying to do that as opposed to being the person that's even doing this. Like somebody else should be doing it that's not me and that's younger than me and is moving forward. So I think there is this, and maybe it's just, I don't want to say it's just human nature, but it seems to be an issue. At least Raul Castro thought it was an issue in Cuba in his latest speech. So I think that's going on. And some people have been, they've become less active as they've gotten older and have kind of like melded into the system or they opened up. They've taken positions where I'm comfortable doing this and, you know, I am up here and everybody's down there and I'm not going to work with them. You know, they want me, they can come get me and I'm willing to talk, but I'm not going to do work. That's been a problem. And then the other thing that I think we've been fighting since the 60s, and I think, you know, Madonna referred to it too, we the culture has become extreme based on me.
Yeah.
The message that we get and that everybody gets is think me and me alone and don't worry about your neighbor, don't worry about, you know, it's their problem. And then to some extent this thing about blaming the person for the condition that they find. If you just hustle some more, if you were just, you know, more dedicated, if you were more committed, you know, and you know, you would succeed, and then every once in a while somebody does make it, and then they're the first one to say, well, if I did it, everybody can do it, which is bullshit, you know. And so I think all of these things have caused the alliances to weaken, and people not to cross, not to be working as closely together. There's a third, this is just programmatic now, there's a third component in what I'm, the school that I'm putting together, call it the collaborative. We're trying to create a platform where people that are doing organizing work, no matter what the issue is, have an opportunity to meet the other people that are doing it and create kind of like a cross-fertilization of people, provide support and assistance and allow people to learn from each other in terms of skill, in terms of knowledge, and that's needed. We don't have enough of those things happening. Sometimes I go to meetings and everybody there is like my generation, and we're all the young people, you know, and younger people. I mean, I'm glad you're all here, quite frankly, because we were just talking outside. You know, you don't have to make all the mistakes that we made. You can make new mistakes, but don't make the mistakes that we made. We already, you know, we can give you some of that and just say, hey, we tried this, you know, maybe the situation's changed, but just know that we did this. And just know there were people people like Madonna in the Puerto Rican community, Evelina Antonetti, Lolita Lebron, there's a whole list of people that have been active in the Puerto Rican community, women, and I just mentioned it was a Madonna that have been active, but nobody knows, very few people know about them and what they've been doing because that history is getting lost. And we're not sharing it. It's not being shared. That's my own take on it.
Well, you know what I noticed over the years, that I kind of was complaining about it, and I realized, well, yeah, that's what's happening, is that a lot of the issues that we all worked on across cultures and in those days and stuff, a lot of our issues got co-opted, okay? And everybody became a non-profit. And then all the attention and the focus turned on raising money, keeping my job, keeping the, you know, more money for keeping everybody employed. The attention, and I think it was a plan. You know, like how do we get these people, the lefties, you know, how do we neutralize them? Well, first of all, we give them a bunch of money, and we, you know, we co-opt the issue. So the fire and the fight is just, you know, because it's all, everything's, the tension now is maintaining that office and those phones and the salaries and the computers and yada, 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 you know. Not all the time, of course, that isn't every situation, but I saw a lot of that happen. And I, you know, and I said, you know what, it used to be in the old days, I mean, I've never sat behind a desk because that's not what I do, you know. And while now, Madonna, you know, we have to start, you know, keeping track of, I said, okay, have at it, I'm out of here. Because I know what I do, you know, my, you know, I'm in the trenches, and that's what I do because that's what I'm good at. I'm not good at raising money and working at a computer and going to meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings. I'm not, that's not me. And there was a place at one time when you're working on an issue and everybody's busy, you know, that's where we were co-opted. Simple as that. Plus, like he said, the me generation came about. We made it, what did we do? I mean, even my own family, you know. I said, you gotta do this and you gotta do that. You gotta get educated because we have to, you know, be in our own schools and take charge of this, that, and the other thing. Well, you know, I didn't realize that the influences of doing all that changes people, you know. So it's really hard for them to maintain that independent way of thinking and doing, where are you going to go to get this education and whatever you're going to do, you know. The influences of the me generation, I mean, it was a struggle. I mean, thankfully my children and my grandchildren survived that, but it was a struggle. I mean, there was times when they said, why can't we do that? Why can't we have that? And I said, no. Stay out of Walmart. You know, things like that.
Question back there?
Thank you for both tonight. Thank you, Madonna, for traveling all this way to talk to us. I was wondering the corruption, or how are the tribal councils, especially where you are, because they're, many of them are still puppet governments, but this government is really good at doing that. Mm-hmm. They've done it in my country until we elected a Hezbollah prime minister, mm-hmm. which basically put a big, nice thorn into this government, mm-hmm. Lebanese people who took over, mm-hmm. call went out, and within a day or two, we had 1.2 million people to oust this government, mm-hmm. but there's still so much corruption.
Yeah,
you know, the same families that started the Civil War are still there, you know, and they're still have their noses in this. But how is it with tribal governments on Cheyenne?
Well, the whole system of tribal governments was started in 1934, when the federal government took the Indian problem, the native problem, out of the War Department. That's who was running the reservations and whatever, up until 1934, the federal Indian policy changed and they created the Indian Reorganization Act. And that created tribal governments patterned after the federal system, federal government system. And there was a big clash all over Indian country in the 30s. Those that didn't want that, they wanted the traditional forms of government, and those that wanted the new. So what the government had done before that was they created all the reservations at the time. They made a grid system. And most of the northern tribes, our people, were matriarchal. They had traditional hunting grounds of extended families, which were called, in our languages, Tioshbaye. That means your extended family. The Tioshbayes all had traditional hunting grounds and areas where they lived and camped, and they followed the herds, and they moved around. So to break that system of traditional government, the federal government created a grid on every reservation of 60 acres. Each grid was 60 acres. And then they made the man the head of the family, legally. So his name was put on the roll, the census. And under there was wife, daughter, son, no names, just the male, because they were trying to break that. Because before that time, everybody had their own name. Nobody took anybody else's name. What's that? What's that all about? You know? So everybody had their own name. But the federal government came in with the Christians, because that's America, forced our people. You took all the, you know, and they said they took all the weapons. Our people didn't have weapons. They had, what they used were for hunting purposes. If you had to, and you consider it a weapon, you consider it a weapon. So then that took care of the hunting to keep the ancestors on the reservations. And then they starved them into submission plus the diseases. So when they set up the IRA tribal governments, it was totally foreign. And since, so we're, our people have always been in transition. We've never had a transition period where we could work, you know, a time to get familiar with some kind of federal Indian policy. They just change policies like this. So our people were constantly in turmoil, constantly. But that's what you do when you want resources and you want land. You break the family unit. You diminish the value system, and you force your way of life on people. Mm-hmm. And first of all, you starve them out, and you know, when you're sick and starving, you'll do anything, I suppose, so your children will live. And then the federal boarding school system and the Christian boarding school system, we don't have time to go through all that.
One last question.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I was wondering if you could talk for a second about the Lakota language, and especially with the younger generations, and if there's work being done to use the language as a unifying force for the people.
Okay, very few families, there are very few families left that are teaching the language at home. The children are learning the language at home. Now it's taught in a real haphazard way in the school systems. But my generation, we were the last generation where you were forbidden to speak your language, and everybody was in a boarding school. My day. So that was the tie to the language was severely cut in those days, in the 50s. And then when the Cultural Revolution happened, or whatever you want to call it, in this country,
of the 60s, when everybody was, all the young people were breaking loose, that is when they overnight, switched the federal Indian policy, closed some of the boarding schools, closed most of them. And all of a sudden now you're gonna, here's your kids, we'll give them back to you. The parenting skills were damaged. There were some families that didn't have parenting skills because their children were in boarding school 9 months of the year. And in the summertime, they just rode horseback and ran wild. And then because they had to go back to prison again in the fall. So the parenting skills for the modern day were not there. So the language was, and there was a few holdouts, you know, in different areas of different reservations where we say full blood because, you know, on reservation and roles of Indian people, it's blood quantum and it's a process. Anyway, so the Indian people that held on to their ways and stuff, they had to go underground. That's why we fought as a people for a law that gave us our right to practice our spiritual ways in 1968. That's when we were given the law, said, okay, you can be Indians now, you can practice your own religion. Well, it wasn't a religion, but it was spiritual ways, you know. We didn't have a religion, a book that tells us what to do and what not to do and who to discriminate against, and the women have to be over here and gotta cover up from head to toe. I mean, we didn't have none of that. It was a spiritual way, but we weren't allowed to do any of that until 1968 in the United States of America. How about that? And then in 1978, a law to protect us from them stealing our children. We had to have a law passed. And then they just brushed the law aside anyway. Doesn't matter.
And just a footnote, the United States invaded Puerto Rico during the Spanish-American War in 1898. And it was awarded to the United States by the treaty that ended the war in 1899. And in 1900, the United States imposed English as the language of instruction in the schools. And that existed until the early 1950s. So you had entire generations that didn't get an education, quite frankly, because at home, in the street, everywhere they went, they were speaking Spanish. The only place they spoke English was in school, and so people dropped out, people didn't learn, and the result is, and part of that result was in the 1940s, you just had, during the 40s and late 40s, early 50s, you just had incredible numbers of people leaving the island because of the economic situation there, and in part, just the cultural alienation that was actually taking place in the island, so that was
important. I mean, the same thing's going on in Arizona now.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the push that's going on. And Arizona is like the one that's getting all the publicity, but there are a lot of states trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
So why don't we give Madonna a round of applause? Acknowledge and honor all of the organizers of the event. Thank you for putting this together, for giving providing the opportunity for Madonna to come and share her wisdom and her knowledge. And I want to thank you also for the opportunity. So, thank you.